Hey everybody, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses, hosted by myself, Dave Cowan, and my good friend Jeff Backus. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. One thing we would ask of you, our listeners, is to rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you're using. We're not exactly sure how or why this helps us, but apparently it does. If you have questions, comments, or would like to be a guest on the Vet Tech Cafe, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. So without further ado, come on in, grab yourself a cup of coffee, and get ready for another episode of the Vet Tech Cafe.
Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe again tonight. Dave, how you doing?
Oh, we're doing all right down here. Really hot. We were hoping we were going to get some of that rain, but apparently we're not.
Yeah, we were supposed to get some today as well. And I've, you know, me is a huge weather nerd. I watch weather radar a fair portion of the day. And it just always goes right around Rhode Island. I don't know why, but today there was severe thunderstorm warnings popping up on my phone like every 5 minutes. I went outside with a beer and I was watching the storm clouds roll in, and they literally just split and went around Rhode Island. So
yeah, we've had thunder all day, but no actual rain has hit the ground here.
Yeah. You have any good coffee you sipping on down there?
I have my Black Silk, you know me.
Nice
coffee.
I found the Dunkin' Donuts coconut in the store again, and Molly just popped the bag and made a pot of it this morning, and it is just fantastic. It's a great summer coffee. I don't think I would have ever thought that I would utter that phrase, summer coffee, but
summer coffee is iced coffee, and you don't like iced coffee.
Well, no, yeah, it is hot, but it is absolutely fantastic. You know, we saw something today on Facebook I sent to you, the AVMA, I'm hoping I'm not going to mess up the moniker, the CVTEA, yes, sent out a survey or has posted a survey about changing some of the language to require veterinary technician students to become rabies vaccinated before any sort of like live handling or anything like that. You're obviously teaching at an AVMA institution. How do you feel about that?
Well,
and are you vaccinated?
I am vaccinated. I was vaccinated when I started working in a shelter many years ago. And, my titers have always been good.
And that is one thing, too. You can provide proof of protective titer levels
and
opt out of the vaccine. Yeah.
The thing that, and I know they mentioned this in the survey, is that the big deciding factor on this is cost.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is really expensive, especially if you can get it to be worked into part of their fees or have the school pay for part of it or have the school pay for it. I think that's a valid thing. However, it's, it kind of crosses a line of a medical procedure that you're having students take. Although I guess if we think about it, having them vaccinated for other things is probably all well and good.
Yeah.
My big thing is going to be the cost of it, because the cost is going to be...
It's pretty expensive.
It is very expensive, and it's a series of shots. And I think when I had mine done back in 97, it was probably about $500. And I think it's more now. So, for a student just coming into tech school, that's got to be something where you're like, I'm spending all this money for tech school, and now we're going to spend another $750 for a rabies vaccine.
And it's an elective thing that's often not covered by insurance. And I know, the hospital I worked at in California, we had kind of talked about it as a hospital some point before I moved to New England about, whether or not we wanted to offer that, like if some of the employees wanted to get vaccinated with the hospital.
Are some clinics that will offer that as well.
And I'm going to go out on a limb and say this was maybe say like 2012 or 2013. And it was about $800 a person. Yeah. So absolutely, there's some associated costs there. But on the flip side of that, I do like the idea, and I'm going to say straight away, I'm not vaccinated. And there are many animals, like again, in my little bubble of Orange County in California, like we didn't have a ton of wildlife. We didn't have a ton of wild animals. We didn't have a lot of rabies suspects ever. And our hospital was right next door to an animal shelter, and they brought in things from time to time, wildlife that they might have done head checks on, that were there for euthanasia. But we never really handled them. Whereas my time in academia, you know where Tufts is. It's far more rural here. Yeah. There's a lot more wild animal bites, wounds of unknown origin. There's just a lot of more stuff here. And we have had several rabies suspects in hospital, and they're always clearly identified. And we've had a couple test positive, you know, more wildlife kind of things. And so, you know, me as an unvaccinated person, I kind of like step away from those patients and allow myself to not be involved with those, which in some ways is kind of nice. but at the same time, the flip side of that is as this survey says, is that, you know, the veterinarians, you know, veterinary students are generally required to be rabies vaccinated in school. You know, should the parallel be that we are as well? And the reality is a lot of times we're actually the ones that are handling these animals.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
And so, you know, on the face of it, I do really think it's a great idea. As you said, I think it's going to come down to cost and whether they build that into tuition, whether they build that into fees, or if, you know, the school can work out some kind of deal with some clinic or something where they can send their students to get vaccinated. I don't know how any of that works.
Or maybe like a group.
Yes, thing. Absolutely. Something. But I do actually think, you know, I do think it is, you know, at least something that needs to be discussed and looked at. You know, I don't know that either answer is right or wrong, because again, as an unvaccinated person, it is nice to recluse myself from yeah. those kinds of things. But at the same time,
well, and here's another thing that you may not have thought of, because you're not really teaching it as I am right now. And in my school may be completely different. In my course, my classes, the classes that I have students actually handling animals, we have rescue groups that send in their animals. I'm never really letting them touch an animal that I think would be dangerous.
Right.
That's not usually something that I want to put them in harm's way. You know, we can have a rabies animal and not actually have it be aggressive at that point. It could
Absolutely.
Be something that's been exposed. So, you know, there's a lot of debate that yeah. can go on with this. And again, my school is maybe completely different than other schools, but my students rarely actually come in contact with an animal that I haven't actually looked at and said, this animal is kind of dangerous. I don't think you should be handling this.
Right, right. Completely agree.
And just because, I mean, think about these students. 50 to 75% of them have never worked in a clinic setting.
Right.
They're not comfortable handling some of these things. And I just taught a animal handling section of one of my classes. And, you know, we went over muscles. We went over using the rabies pole and went over different restraint techniques. And, you know, we'll talk to Tabitha tonight about all those things that I could be doing differently. But for the most part, I told them, I said, you know, as you guys get out into the field and you get into your first job, you're not going to be handling the dogs and the cats that are going to be fractious.
Yeah.
That's not something they're going to put you, they're not going to say, okay, first day on the job, here's your first fractious cat, go at
right.
it. That's
right.
not going to happen. It just doesn't happen.
Well, hopefully not.
Hopefully not, yeah.
yeah. Yeah. But anyway, you know, I definitely think it's something to think about. I think it's a really good discussion to have. And you know, maybe one of these days, the next couple of days, we can post a link to the survey, regardless
yeah,
of,
yeah.
of, you know, we're not here talking about it to influence anybody else's thoughts. But whatever your, you know, as veterinary technicians and nurses that might be listening to this, whatever your thoughts are, if you're in the U.S., we'll post a link where you can go to this. Go take the survey. It's literally like two or three questions.
Yeah.
And all the language is right there. You can read what they want to add to it and what they want to change. And all they're looking for really is feedback. So whether you're for it, whether you're against it, whether you think this is a problem or that is a problem, absolutely go check it out and let your voice be heard. You know,
yeah.
that's something we want to encourage to everybody. Like, let your voice be heard, because you have ideas, you have thoughts, and there are people that need to hear them. So,
yeah.
So you kind of already mentioned our guest. What do you think? Should we get a cup of coffee yeah. and bring her on out?
Yeah, let's get some coffee and bring her out.
All right. So tonight's guest on the Vet Tech Cafe is Tabitha Kucera. We're really excited to have her come by and talk all things behavior. But she's an elite fear-free and low-stress handling certified registered veterinary technician. And we'll explain these acronyms, but CCBC and KPA-CTP. She's the owner of Chirrups and Chatter Cat and Dog Behavior Counseling and Training in Cleveland, Ohio. And you can follow on Instagram at Chirrups and Chatter. Talk to her a little bit about that later on. She's been working with dogs and cats with a number of rescue organizations and small animal practices. She completed her low stress handling and fear-free certifications and graduated from the Karen Pryor Academy, that's the KPA, obtaining her CTP, and became a certified cat behavior consultant through the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants. Loves educating others on riding, behavior consulting, lecturing, all things dogs and cats. cats, including feline and canine behavior, working with fearful animals, fear-free handling, and all that kind of goes into that. She's a fear-free certified speaker, trainer mentor for Cat Positive Pro, serves as the co-chair of Pet Professional Guild's Cat Committee, and serves on the board of the Together Initiative for Ohio's Community Cats. And
that is a lot of hats.
That's a lot of hats to wear. And I think the coolest, well, not the coolest one, but one that's like a really big deal at the end, she was also named one of the 10 Vet Tech Superstars to Follow for 2020 by DVM 360 Magazine. So Tabitha, thank you so much for taking some time and coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. Can we get you a cup of coffee?
Yes, I would love that. I'm actually drinking coffee. I know it's late as we record this, but I'm a late night owl and I live for coffee. So
what can we get you?
An iced coffee with a dash of soy milk.
All right.
Nice. Iced coffee. You're speaking to Dave there.
Yeah, that's my coffee. Iced coffee.
It is
all day, every day.
It's 9:30 in the evening for Dave and I as we record this. I think you're in Ohio. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm drinking caffeinated coffee as well. So I slept in this morning. It's my first day off of my weekend. I've got baseball to watch later and a NASCAR race to watch later. So I'm going to be up late. I'm going to have a cup of coffee myself. So we always kind of start out with having our guests tell us their career path, because everybody gets to where they are a little bit differently. So take a few minutes and take us through kind of what drew you to working in veterinary medicine all the way up to where you are now.
Sure. So my path, and I love that you asked that because everyone's paths are so different. I grew up loving animals as many of us did. I actually did not want to be a veterinarian or a veterinary technician. I was an angsty goth kid that actually hated school in high school. And then after as you age and grow up, in my very early 20s, I grew up loving animals and volunteering at shelters. And I actually met a registered veterinary technician because honestly, prior to that, I didn't know that this was a career idea. And then I was like, I know what I want to do for a living, which is great for me being so young because I've stuck with it and I can't imagine doing anything else. But I then applied to veterinary technician school. As I went to school, I continued to work with shelters. I worked at a boarding facility part-time, going to school full-time. And then actually right before my VTNE, I got an internship at a farm sanctuary, which was only supposed to be 3 months, but they offered me a job and I couldn't say no. Because that was one, you know, you have these dream jobs and then as you age, you're like, was that a dream job? And I worked at a farm sanctuary in New York for about a year, which was awesome because I got to work with some of my favorite animals, pigs, goats, cows, all that fun stuff, including cats and dogs. But it was a really cool experience. But I am a city girl, so I love the farm life as far as living on the farm and being with the animals. But the non-internet, the only place to shop being Walmart, those types of things weren't great for me. So I headed back home to Cleveland, Ohio, and took my VTNE a little late, which I do not recommend. I took it a year. I think it was 6 months to a year after I graduated because the job was not planned. And I passed, which is great. And then I started working in small animal practices. I worked at quite a few. I love that you talk about how important it is for technicians to speak up because I do that a lot. There are a lot of places that I just wasn't a good fit for a variety of reasons. I had some ethical compromises. They may have told me certain things were going to happen that didn't happen. We've all worked at those clinics with toxicity and things like that. I worked at a variety of veterinary clinics. And in that time, I also worked with shelters and I started seeing a lot of behavioral issues. And I remember being like, I'm going to look this up to help my clients because that's what we do as technicians. And there was very minimal information that was accurate. And I was like, if technicians that don't have this information, how in the heck does the general public? And then all these things I started seeing made a lot more sense. Because unfortunately, behavior kills a lot of animals. And many of behavior issues can be prevented with education. So that's what kind of led me down this path of behavior. And I actually started working towards my VTS in behavior, which I am testing for this year, vomit. And I became fear-free certified. I saw the amazing Dr. Sophia Yin speak prior to her passing, who has been, I can't begin to tell you how much of an inspiration that woman is and will continue to be for the rest of my life. And that's when I saw, because we all know our animals are fearful when we handle them, but as a technician, I was doing with the best with what I could at that moment. And I saw her speak and I was like, I can do so many things differently and the animals will be a lot less fearful. So this was a little bit before Fear Free came out. So I obtained my low stress handling certification, then my Fear Free certification. And then I just continue to go down this path because I love learning. I'm a little bit of a CE junkie. I then started working towards my Karen Pryor, my KPA, CTP, and continuing to work through my BTS. And then working in general practice, I began speaking because I'm an extroverted person. I love educating others and I love people and animals. So I started speaking a lot and then I started writing. I was still working in GP. I was like doing behavior consulting and preventative care in GP. And then I was like, I should probably start my own business, which was terrifying because I don't know business. I'm not going to claim I'm getting better at it. But I was still in GP at the time. And I started with cats, seeing only cats for behavior outside of practice. And then everything just started to blow up very quickly. And I was like, whoa, there's a need for this. Like, insane amounts, and I didn't realize it, and the business went really well. So then I made the terrifying decision at the time, and now I'm like, why didn't I do this sooner, to leave general practice? But I think all of us have felt this, and I talk to technicians about this a lot. The idea of not working in general practice, it's silly, but you feel like you're not a technician, and that's really hard. And that's something I struggled with. I do low-cost vaccine clinics. I work with shelters. I have so many awesome jobs. I still work with vet clinics and do consulting, but it was really hard for me to make that leap, harder than you can ever imagine. And then when I did, I was like, why didn't I do this sooner? And again, my business kind of blew up and I started being booked out for months at a time. I would get asked to do more and more things. I got involved with Cat Positive, which is a dream job of mine, which is basically we work with shelters to teach them cat behavior and how to clicker train cats, which makes them more adoptable, and how to deal with behavior issues. And that's just one of my many lovely hats that I get to wear. And that's kind of my path. I know that was a really long answer.
No, that's not fantastic. Some time ago, after I had gotten my VTS, I kind of wanted to start speaking like you talked about. And I remember I was having a conversation with Ken Yagi at a conference in California several years ago. And I asked him, like, how, you know, I kind of want to start doing this. How do you do it? And he said, find your niche, like find your thing that you're most passionate about, that you're going to be the most excited to teach, and then become the authority on it. And it sounds like that's exactly what you have done. And that's just awesome to hear.
Yeah. That's awesome advice. Very passionate about what I do, and I'm a very high energy person. And when I start talking about behavior, I just become, I don't know, I become this other person. I'm like, I'll talk to you about litter boxes for 5 hours. Let's do this. I really enjoy it. And I mean, I'm sure you could relate as a teacher, teaching people, because being a trainer, a lot of it is teaching. Like a lot of people say training is teaching. It's the same thing. I love teaching. It's just my favorite thing ever. And making those connections, I do miss my in-person conferences, but making those connections with people and helping to lift each other up, it's just beautiful.
Well, and we often talk about those aha moments, right? When we're teaching, we're seeing their face light up and say, ah, I get it now. That's like such a rewarding thing. That's one of the things that I love about teaching right now. And, you know, behavior is one of those things where, you know, as I'm teaching my classes now, it's, you know, I'm teaching some restraint. I'm telling them that I haven't done the whole fear-free certification yet, but I'm actually starting to go through that process. And I can't wait to be able to actually give them that information as opposed to just saying, okay, this is how you scruff a cat, because that's really not something that's going to be really helpful for them.
And that's a wonderful observation. And that's so great that you acknowledge that, because I always, when I lecture, I always say, I love veterinary medicine because we call it practicing medicine because we're always improving and getting better and progressing. And the fact that many of us are still being taught how to restrain animals the same techniques we were taught when we didn't think they felt pain. I mean, I don't want to say it's barbaric, but it really kind of is when you think about it, because anesthesia, pain meds, all of these other things have progressed. And a lot of technician schools and veterinarian schools are making changes, which is beautiful, because I definitely want to focus and reinforce those amazing people and people like yourselves who are like, I'm going to do this fear-free. And I'm really stoked about teaching my students newer techniques that they will probably be more effective and set them up for success.
Right. Yeah. And that's the whole point of it is to give them more opportunities. And I've told them not to get off on a tangent here, but we've taken advantage of the Recover program where they were able to get in and go through the Recover program to get online certification. And I'm going to be able to do the in-person certification at some point. But I tell them anything that you can grab onto to get something to put on your resume, like Fear Free or Recover certification, makes you a more marketable technician. It makes you more valuable to your employer. So I always tell them, if there's anything that you can do to put on your resume, just do it. Anything that's on your resume that's going to make you more attractive to an employer is something you definitely need to do.
Especially when it's like helping your patients and
exactly,
you know, bringing new ideas to a clinic. Then again, they can go, you know, teach or you know, educate some people that they work with. Like, right. Hey, you know, when right. I was in school, like I learned this thing about Fear Free. Oh, well, what's that? Let's have a conversation and you know, look at it and see if we, you know, can get the clinic certified and, you know, educate the public about it. And yeah, it's a good cycle.
Yeah. This is another thing that we've been trying to ask our guests. When you think about your career as a veterinary technician and what you're doing right now, what is one thing that you absolutely love about it? And what is one thing that you would change about it?
I love the opportunities I have every single day to help strengthen the human-animal bond between, so basically strengthen that bond between whether it's a client and their pet, or it's a veterinarian better understanding their patients from a behavior standpoint so they can do more accurate pain assessments because a lot of that's behavior, or so they can not get bit. I mean, that's great too. So that's probably my favorite thing, connecting with people and helping them to better understand and relate to their animal companions or patients.
Yeah.
Now, my least favorite thing.
Uh-oh.
You said be honest. Yeah, right. I would probably say the amount of toxicity in our field and how often it gets ignored or pushed under a rug. Mm. Unfortunately, I've had a lot of experiences where things have not been addressed properly and I have handled them or left that practice. And I always tell technicians, I know it sounds silly, but the grass is greener on the other side, and although you feel like you have learned helplessness and you're just stuck, because I've even felt that way, and I'm very confident and I have felt that way. Just put yourself out there. Try to say yes sometimes. If you're uncomfortable, say it, because it makes a big difference. And some of the practices I've worked for, we've made a lot of positive changes because we started that conversation versus me being like, "Arg, this place is horrible," and not really.
I'm leaving.
Yeah, not really. But if ethically you are comfortable, if you're like, "I'm over threshold, I can't focus, I can't think, I cry in the bathroom every day," it's okay to then be like, "This isn't a good fit for me."
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
Well, we've talked about this. There's a vast shortage of technicians in this field, right? So you know that there's some hospital that needs people. So if the hospital you're in is not a good fit, and like you said, if you're crying in the bathroom every day, then that's not something you should be doing. No. You shouldn't be there.
Don't be afraid to look for other opportunities.
That's right.
In your opinion, what is the biggest obstacle that veterinary technicians face in this field?
The lack of opportunity for advancement.
Mm.
Now, in my situation, I have took it upon myself to advance my career. And I think, again, I'm a writer, I'm a speaker, I work as an independent contractor. Like, I have a list of amazing things I do as a veterinary technician, and you can too. But I can't lie. And honestly, a lot of the practices I worked at, no one supported me. I'm just so passionate that I said, I don't care if you don't support me, I'm going to continue to do this. But I can understand how that could be a huge obstacle for some people when they're already feeling kind of burnt out, and then they don't get money for CE, or they don't get the days off to go to a conference, which I've worked at places where they wouldn't allow me to. I got a speaking opportunity at a large conference, and I only get 5 days off a year, and there's no, we can't talk about it, you know?
Right.
Again, there are opportunities for advancements for veterinary technicians. Like, there's, because all of us do amazing things, including general practice or ER. But I feel like even at practices I worked at, with my motivation and passion, it was really hard to advance sometimes.
Yeah, I completely agree. I've definitely had speaking opportunities as well that I you know, I mean, I feel like I even in my job have lots of time off for the year, but I didn't want to take away vacation time to go lecture at a conference. Like, that's not a vacation. That's working. That's like, then that's actually me out there putting a feather in the cap of the hospital or university or wherever that I work in, right? I mean, right. I'm out there promoting them too. But then to, you know, to not be able to pursue that opportunity or have to sacrifice, you know, actual time away from the profession in the form of a vacation to do so is, yeah, I definitely can relate to that.
You know, like you said, you're kind of a self-motivator and you're going to do it whether someone supports you or not. And I think that's probably a hard thing in our field for other technicians is you're working your butt off and you want to do all these other things, but you don't really have time and you don't really have the motivation and then you don't have the support of it. Then it's like, well, why am I going to bother? Right. So
yeah.
Being a self-starter and a self-motivator, I think is a huge, huge thing that people need to actually start doing.
Right. Right. Especially when it's something you can bring to your practice, like fear-free.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like we'll get into that, but I, you know, that's something that you can tangibly improve a practice on, and you know, you can interact with your clients and your patients better, and we can handle the patients better and treat them better and easier, and it just, that's like a very tangible thing that
definitely.
Yeah.
Tabitha, can you just explain exactly what is fear-free? And because I'm going through the process now, but can you just explain what the whole certification process looks like?
For sure. So fear-free is basically an online, they have in person, but the certification is done all online at your own pace, and it basically focuses on the fact that our patients don't only need their physical well-being taken care of, but now we know traditionally restraining.
Person handling?
See, I'm Kaz, you guys. You guys made me feel comfortable. For example, for like tech piling on a dog for a nail trim, which is something I have done in my career, which mm-hmm. actually makes me very physically ill. But I was doing the best with what I could in the moment that I knew. Basically, we know now that that can cause pretty acute and long-term issues. And we weren't really working to take care of their emotional well-being. We're like, we have to cut their nails. Let's get it done. This is their fit. Like, their nails are long. We need to cut them. But we weren't really taught. And low stress handling touched on this, but this is a pretty new thing for our fields. And to be fair, in the human fields, addressing mental well-being is something that we need to come a long way in as well, because people are still holding kids down for vaccines. And I think that that's a little outdated, because I think animals and humans are very similar, and they are in the way that they learn and think and take in things. So fear-free is all about not only giving you tools, protocols, procedures, and guidelines on how to physically help your patient safely, but also how to address their emotional well-being and basically reduce their fear, stress, and anxiety that we often see, whether you're working at a shelter or at a veterinary clinic. And they provide online and in-person continuing education programs and certification. The veterinary certification, there's veterinarian, there's a groomer one, there's a trainer one, there's a shelter one. And the fear-free certification is actually free for veterinary students or technician students, the first level. And it takes about 8 hours. And again, you kind of go at your own pace, but it's all module based.
Because I'm a teacher, I got a code to go through it for like the same cost as a student. So I didn't realize that the students could do it for free too. So now I think somebody's going to have a project in one of the next classes. I'm always looking for projects. So we can get certified fear-free as technicians and doctors and assistants and all that. How do hospitals and practices become fear-free certified?
So that's a little more of an in-depth process. So you need a certain amount of your staff to go through the fear-free certification. And then similar to how the cat-friendly practice has that list of things that we would like you to cover, someone basically, you have a certain amount of your practice fear-free certified. Not 100%. I think it's 30%, but I could be wrong. But you get a large amount of your practice fear-free certified and start implementing those protocols and procedures throughout your hospital. Because again, as a technician, I can make a difference, but really what makes the best difference is everyone on the staff being on board, of course. Yeah. And then they have someone come in and kind of observe and monitor and see what you're doing. And then you obtain that amazing fear-free certified practice.
Oh, so somebody actually comes in and certifies you.
Right. Right now it's probably a little different.
Well, yeah.
Obviously. But prior to lovely COVID, someone would come and assess and they offer support for questions people may have throughout the process and all that wonderful stuff
right,
too.
Right. And then we said in your bio that you're elite fear-free. What is elite fear-free? Is that just like AP fear-free?
So oh, I like that. He's such a teacher. Oh my gosh. So there's level one, level two, level three. And then I've been Fear Free certified for longer than 3 years. So the next step up is elite. So basically what happens is you obtain level one, and then in order to remain certified, you have to keep up with CE, and generally that level two would cover that. Mm. And then at elite, they have a lot of up-to-date. The one thing I really love about Fear Free, there's very few organizations. I love a lot of organizations, but there's very few that I feel confident in most of their content that they put out. Like, I can say confidently that these are science-based certified people, or they're veterinary professionals, and not necessarily just an influencer. Not that I'm judging, but that's really important when it comes to putting out education. And they are really great at continuing to put up new CE from amazing, like, board certified veterinarians. And it's just beautiful. And they get a wide array of opinions. So there's veterinary technicians, there's trainers. It's really nice that it's not all coming from just one person. It's a lot of our different, because all of our experiences are valuable, and Fear Free is really good about, I feel comfortable telling a client to be like, go to fearfreehappyhomes.com. I know they'll find good stuff there, and I don't have to dread that they might do something, especially with behavior. They might, meaning well, go to the internet and Google something and do something really damaging to their cat or dog based on what they saw on a website. Right. Or a technician did something. Again, they were trying to learn more, and they might have just been at a bad resource. So Fear Free is really great about keeping things up to date and continuing to offer more and more and more webinars for us to watch, which is great.
Gotcha. In your bio, we talked about the Karen Pryor Academy certification and the CTP. So my questions are, is A, and excuse my ignorance, but who is Karen Pryor? What does the Karen Pryor Academy look like, and what is CTP?
So Karen Pryor is amazing. She is basically, I don't want to say the founder, but essentially the founder of Clicker Training.
Okay.
And there's a lot of misconceptions about behavior, which I'm sure you guys are even aware of, some of those, like those dominance-based theories, you have to control your dog, some of these concerning things that are really highlighted, I like to say social fog. There's a lot of social fog out there that is strengthening these. So Karen Pryor was ahead of her time, similar to Sophia Yen, and she uses a lot of B.F. Skinner, so apparent conditioning, counter conditioning, all that fun stuff. And she was the first person that was recognized. She wrote a book called Don't Shoot the Dog, which I highly recommend. And it was all about using positive reinforcement training techniques, basically adding something the animal likes, because you might like something different than I like. So something the animal likes to increase a behavior, and focusing on what we want the animal to do versus focusing on what we want the animal not to do, which unfortunately, it doesn't work great with humans either. And as a technician, I was often told what not to do and not told what to do. And that was really frustrating. So I can imagine how frustrating it is for a cat or dog. So she wrote that book and started a lot of the positive reinforcement movement. And the Karen Pryor Academy was basically born of the many requests the company received from dog trainers to help set standards for good training and good teaching practices, because unfortunately dog training isn't well regulated, neither is cat training definitely isn't, but anyone can call themselves a dog trainer, which is really concerning. And I'll be honest, before I got into behavior, it hurts my heart to say this, but I would literally Google trainers and give the copy of the list to my clients, and now I understand how detrimental that is. I always joke with veterinarians who may not understand, that's like you Googling reading a vaccine protocol on a blog and buying those vaccines. Like, it's so, not to be rude, but behavior kills way more animals than vaccines do, for sure. Yeah. So that's where Karen Pryor Academy was started, and they offer a lot of online training webinars. Like, they have a fun Train Your Cat, if you guys want to click or train your cats, because you all do. They offer a fun Train Your Cat course. So there's a Better Vet Visit course. So these are shorter courses where you could just go to learn more, which I highly recommend. But then there's the actual dog trainer professional course, and that's a 6-month program where you do online work, in-person workshops, and then you're actually tested on working with the dog and actually working with people. You have to do a class. That's another thing I really like about the Karen Pryor Academy. So if you pass all of that, you then become a certified training partner or CTP. And I love the certification because you're held accountable for how you interact with people and animals. And you can have your certification revoked if you don't meet their standards or don't keep up with continuing education. And a lot of the dog training programs out there, unfortunately, don't necessarily have those similar standards.
That's really interesting that you can have that revoked for not keeping up. That's kind of a good like check and balance. I like that.
I love it.
And you mentioned in there, in practices that I've worked at, we did the exact same thing where here's a business card of some trainer that left business cards.
Right.
What's a good way for us as technicians and as hospital staff to be able to recommend quote unquote dog trainers or cat trainers?
That's a wonderful question. So I work with a lot of veterinarians. I think every veterinarian should have a variety of, or at least one animal behavior professional, either on their staff or that they work closely with. KPA CTPs is one of the organizations that like veterinary behaviorists often feel comfortable referring to. So it is one of those few ones that I feel fairly comfortable all the time referring to. There's other great dog trainers who have certifications, but the standards of care may be a bit different. So AVSAB actually has a really great handout on how to find a dog trainer that I love. And it basically talks about what I would say. So they should be using science-based positive, which again, if you don't do behavior, you may not know what the up-to-date science-based methods are, but usually that's positive reinforcement. So they aren't using items like scat mats, which is a horrible thing, that it's a mat that a cat jumps on and it shocks them. It makes my heart hurt. And then like shock collars, prong collars. Basically, if you need to use manipulation or force to train something, there's a pretty big problem there. Or sometimes someone will use the word balance training, and this is where it can get really hard to know that sounds okay, but balance training means I might shock you occasionally. And I know that sounds weird, but I've heard these electric collars be called massage collars. There's a lot of, it could be very easy to accidentally work with one of these type of trainers and be misled. So that's where it can be really hard. So I always recommend they should be comfortable working with a vet. That's a huge thing. They should be comfortable with vaccines. Obviously, you guys are aware of why that is, but I have to tell that to the general public. If you don't mesh well, so like you should be able to ask questions, and which is the same thing I tell my clients about finding vets, you should be able to ask questions. They should have continued CE. So I have a lot of CE on my website and certifications, and I'm always learning. They should be too. And then again, that's where we look at the certifications. And usually if a veterinarian is going to start referring to a behavior professional, they should at least see their facility. They should see them train and they should meet with them. Like, for example, I see aggression. I see cooperative care. I see a lot of things. Not all trainers are comfortable with all of those things, which is okay. But that way you're not referring an aggression case to a trainer who may not be comfortable with that. So it just helps everyone be on the same page. And I know that may seem like a lot of work, but just have them come in for a lunch and learn and do maybe a introduce themselves kind of thing, get some free food, and then you can ask some of these questions and then you can build a relationship. And then you, like, the vets that refer to me love me because half the time I see underlying medical issues that need to be addressed. But it's this beautiful partnership, and I call them and tell them what I'm seeing. And a lot of the times, the clients, not maliciously, especially with cats, but I've had cats who were having seizures and the vets had no idea. Just things like that. So the fact that I get to go in these homes and talk to these clients and see these patients, it's a real, I mean, I am a technician, which helps. I mean, I'm not going to lie. That helps a little bit. But I think getting all that information and working a little bit to get good recommendations and referrals is important. Just like you would a specialist. I mean, I love all specialists, but usually, as a veterinary professional, we like the specialists we like. And yeah, that's again, that we mesh well. Because again, they might be wonderful at surgery, but they may not check in or give me updates about my patient. That's a problem, right?
Yeah.
So that's where I wish I could be like, it's black and white, but I would recommend all of those lovely things.
Yeah.
For technicians that kind of want to follow in your footsteps, what's the first step? Obviously getting some certification under their belt, like a fear-free. But in terms of just kind of doing something similar to this, where do they really start?
So I would just recommend starting where I started. Yeah. Again, I'm a CE junkie. And right now, one benefit to COVID is there is more online CE than you can ever imagine. Because I started with veterinary conferences and seeing veterinary behaviorists speak. That's really where I started getting into behavior. And then I started getting into Clicker Expo and Karen Pryor and some of these other outlets, because there's so many. Joining the Society of Veterinary Behavior Technicians, if this is something you're really interested in, is a great thing. It's a safe place. So, and I mean that, we all know Facebook can be a hit or miss. So it's a safe place if you have questions, because a lot of these things can be hard, especially when you don't know. We can help you get to the right methods or find the right trainer or help you with that cat, or at least give you some places to go that are reliable and up to date. And then also, of course, the networking, and then we have webinars. It's just a great thing. And then also reading a few books. So I do highly recommend Canine and Feline Behavior for Veterinary Technicians by the amazing Debbie Martin and Julie Shaw, who have done their VTSs in behavior. That's more of a textbook, but some of shorter books that are really great is Reaching the Animal Mind or Don't Suit the Dog by Karen Pryor, The Trainable Cat by John Bradshaw and Sarah Ellis, anything by John Bradshaw, The Eye of the Trainer by Ken Ramirez. So basically anything by Karen Pryor, Debbie Martin, or Ken Ramirez is a good...
See, those like we're going to have a lot of links to put in
great
show notes for this episode.
But then as you read more, you'll find, because again, I work with dogs, but I'm obviously really well known for cats. And I would say that there might, like, I do a lot of cooperative care with cats, which unfortunately is not as common. So I train cats to happily accept meds and to cooperate in their blood draw and things like that. I think that was my niche. So by reading, starting with these few things, like learning more, going to CE, reading books, you might be like, cooperative care is my favorite thing, which as a technician, you probably will.
I'm going to be a little bit naive here. It's been many years since I went to a non-emergency conference. Do the other conferences have like behavior CE that's at them, like NAVTA or FETCH or some of those other big conferences? Do they have behavior lectures?
They do. Thankfully, the behavior game is strong lately, especially. It's getting way more understood and wanted. Like every conference, those are the classes that are filled. My go-to's, like, we all have our favorite conferences, but I love VMX and Midwest Veterinary Conference in Ohio. But most conferences, like Fetch, and they have behavior tracks, and they have a variety of them. So they have a behavior technician track. And then they may have a few veterinary, like you might have a cat behavior specific AFP behavior track, and then Fear Free has its own track. So there's a lot of, because even with behavior, there's so many places you can go with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's funny. I think just because, Jeff, you've gone to other conferences because you're speaking at them, but I mean, I haven't gone to anything but IVEX for the last, 8-10 years. So I don't remember ever seeing behavior at IVEX.
I definitely have, but again, even still, like, you know, when I did VMX 2 years ago or whatever it was, I went in for the day that I was speaking, and then, you know, that was all I wasn't there the whole time, so I, you know, unfortunately didn't pay attention. But I imagine those that are, especially those that are more geared towards, you know, I'll say general practice, but just a broader reach of, you know, there's some medicine stuff, there's some neuro stuff, there's some emergency stuff, there's some behavior stuff, some cardio stuff, like, you know, those that can, you know, cast a really wide net. And that's fantastic to see that's like another type of track option available for technicians and veterinarians as well. Is there a particular story or maybe animal as you've kind of gone through this process to where you are now that you've worked with that stands out from a behavior standpoint, either one that, you know, you specifically have worked with or one that maybe you saw while you were still working in clinics that stands out that it was like, this is the kind of patient I want to work with? Is there one kind of thing that stands out among the rest?
I don't love painful animals, but especially in cats. Yeah. The amount of cats I have worked with who have had an aggression type behaviors, whether it's being fearful. So I don't really use the word fractious very much, because not that I don't truly see fractious animals. It's just, I'm a big fan of language. And I think the like these fractious signs that I see in practices, I'm like, this cat is not this cat is fearful, and language matters. So the really fearful cats that I see who are showing aggression either at the vet or in homes, how many cases, I have so many, where the cats are struggling or suffering from chronic pain, and for a variety of reasons, it was never diagnosed or managed. And I worked along with the veterinarian and the client, and it makes me want to cry. But these cats, because again, I hate labels. Well, hate is a label. I dislike, see, I'm working on it, guys. I dislike labels. And I hear words like grumpy cat a lot, like, and I'm always like, that triggers me a bit. I'm like, grumpy cats are usually painful cats or fearful cats. And we got them on some pain management, and I help the clients understand body language and consent and what that looks like in a cat. And these cats, like, I'm not even lying. I get updates like every 2 weeks from clients I've seen 3 years ago about how amazing I am. And I'm like, Tex, I want you to feel this way. Get into behavior. Because you deserve it. Because, again, it wasn't malicious in most parts. There's a lot of reasons, which you guys are probably familiar with, which why pain doesn't get diagnosed or managed or addressed. But I've had so many, like, those are probably, I don't want to say my favorite, but the most heart-touching cases.
Okay.
Where these cats were just horribly painful. And like the moment they are on pain meds, they are like completely different cats. They're cuddling with their owners now, but a lot of owners would be like, my cat's just a butthead. That's normal. And I'm like, it's not normal. Stop saying that. I need you to understand, like, grumpy cat is not funny. But again, as a technician, I'm sure I used to be that tech,
right?
You know, and now I'm like, labels are important. The language we use is really important. And then also, animals who have been fired from vet clinics due to fear-based aggression. So I love fear-based aggression. And I've worked with a lot of cats and dogs who have been fired from their veterinary clinics. And I've been able to give them vaccines and help them be examined and get blood work in a non-stressful way. And that's also, I mean, it's life-changing. There's really no other way to say it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you talk about cats there and grumpy cats and fractious cats, which leads me right into my next question, which is, you know, there's been a lot of talk the last week, 2 weeks, couple weeks about the validation of the feline grimace scale. And I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
I love it. I love pain scores. I think every patient should have a fear, anxiety, stress score and a pain score every time, every appointment. Now, I'm a huge fan of pain scales as a tool, but I also need, of course, we can't just be like, this is black and white, this is an exact science.
Right.
So that's where, if I'm working with a veterinarian clinic or a lot of shelters, because I recently posted about that and I got a lot of awesome feedback about it, because so many behavioral issues are due to underlying medical issues, and a big one is pain in cats and dogs, that I tell them, like, we have to teach you body language first. We need to teach you what normal looks like, and then we're going to teach you what pain looks like, and then we're going to make sure the whole staff is on board. We're going to show photos or videos, because I have quite a few, of cats who are in pain, and we're going to grade them together. Then we're going to start using this scale, because I'm sure I've worked at places that have done this too, but just being like, we're going to do a pain score, and then you have five vets and they're all scoring differently. And again, I'm not saying that they're wrong, but it's really important to get everyone on the same page. Or if you're doing a pain assessment, you know, if you're using a pain score, there are guidelines on how to use those. Like, generally, we should have some sort of a baseline. So you should be asking. I'm a big fan of having every single one of my clients, every exam, they bring 3 to 5 videos of their animals acting normal at home, especially cats, because between prey and predator and flight and fight, like, I'm in fight or flight, my pain perception's decreased. Again, even the best veterinarian in the world is going to miss pain because of those things. So the amount of, like, abnormal gaits and things I see in the home where I'm like, hey, just take videos of your cats, because we know our clients' ideas of normal very different than ours. So it really helps to set us up for success to better accurately diagnose pain and manage it and reassess it. Like, hey, we sent you home with pain meds. We sent you home with some seniorifying your house ideas, like elevating plates, stairs, all that fun stuff. here's a pain scale. This is what that means. I have my clients do that too. Because once we do the pain meds, now that you know what pain looks like, you can accurately, instead of when I call saying fine, which I used to accept that answer and that upsets me, now I know my clients didn't know what pain looked like. And that's why most of the cats weren't getting the pain meds when they were prescribed by the vet. Now, I like all of these things come make sense. They're not just like incompliant buttheads. Their cat was fine. They thought that's another word. They thought their cat was fine. So I'm a huge fan of the facial grimace scale, but I'm a fan of pain scales in general. And there's so many wonderful ones out there. So find one you like, talk to your practice about it, start getting it in your practice for sure.
Yeah.
Tabitha, you've been talking about business that you've been doing, and it's called Chirps and Chatter. Is that correct?
Yes.
And where did you come up with that name first?
So there are two cat sounds.
People
think they're bird sounds, and I'm like, I like birds, but I don't know much about them. I know chickens and turkeys, like farm ones, but other birds. So the chatter is when the cats are at your window looking at something outside, kind of chattering their teeth. Mm. And then the chirrup is kind of like a trill. When you come in your home, if you have a cat, they go up to you and do this beautiful sound. I can't hear.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. Okay. With that business, so this is your consultation business, right? So what kind of services do you provide? Do you go into people's homes and do this? And what does that whole consultation process look like?
I started smaller, but now I offer quite a lot. So I offer just general cat and dog behavior consulting services, which is what I'm most commonly hired for, where your cat may be house soiling or your dog may be fearful or whatever it may be. And I have them fill out a behavior questionnaire so I can get somewhat of an idea of the history, because that really matters in the environment and what they've done to address it in the past. And that also helps me get a better understanding of the client so I can approach it more from meet them where they are. And then generally right now I'm doing virtual consults, which behavior is great because in most cases that's actually better because I see a lot of aggression. But usually I would go to their house, we go over the consult form together. And then like for a cat, for example, I'm going to walk through their house and assess where the cat's resources are. Like, again, I could talk about litter boxes forever, like where their litter boxes are, where are their vertical spaces, meet their cats, talk. And then I already have an idea of the plan. So I always give a safety and management plan, because safety first, of course, and management. So for example, I'm going to give them things that they can do right now. Like if their cat happens to be spraying on a counter, I'm not saying that this is most likely the issue, but it's very commonly something outside that is causing the cat stress. So I'm like, as management for right now, cover your windows while we implement behavior modification, because behavior mod takes time. But obviously I want to give them things right now, or I'm going to tell you right now how to read your cat's body language so you can please, your cat does not bite your hand out of nowhere, even though that's what it feels like. This is how to read your cat. And then I also create like a behavior modification form. And then that includes follow-up phone calls and emails to address, and then as needed, I'll have additional sessions with them. But usually with cats, I meet the clients once or twice, and the first consult is pretty lengthy. It's a few hours.
Oh, wow.
There's a lot to go through.
Yeah, I bet. When you have clients that reach out to you for the first time, do you find that because they're reaching out to you, they're pretty committed to what you're going to recommend? Or are you met with a lot of, that sounds kind of cuckoo and I'm just not going to do that. Thank you for your time.
That's something I have gotten way better at. If you would have told me when I was 25 that I was going to be reading books on communication, I would have flicked you off. I'm just being honest. And now, and I think honestly, it's super corny to say, but because animals and humans learn very similarly, basically the same, I've always been an extroverted person, but getting into behavior has made me such a better person as far as being able to empathize, meet people where they are, communicate more effectively. So I don't have that as much now. I very rarely do. Clients are usually fairly compliant. But again, I think 10 years ago, I'm like, this client's just difficult. It's not me. Blah, 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 all the things we say. And now I'm like, I didn't really see the whole picture, or I wasn't communicating effectively. I didn't give that person a chance. I have worked very hard to effectively communicate because I have to deal just like many technicians do, most of my calls are clients who are so over threshold that they may say something like, I'm going to euthanize my cat if you don't help me, which used to be something that was really hard. I mean, I'm not going to say it's not hard for me, but it used to be really hard for me to hear. And now I understand, in most to all cases, now I have had the few, just like we all have texts to, we do meet some bad people, but it is very few. But usually they're just in such, like, my cat has been house-soiling for 10 years, and my friends are telling me, whether it's a dog or cat, my friends are telling me to just shock it or throw it outside or all these absurd things that I'm sure their friends read a blog or saw Cesar Millan. Ah, trigger warning for me. Or again, they're coming from a good place. And everyone, because I hear people say, oh, your cat's peeing. That should, and I'm like, whoa. That's a really weird perspective. So, and clients always tell me, I've tried everything. And I'm sure you guys hear this too. And I say, I'm like, the great news is, so I could say really serious things and not upset people. I don't know why, but I'll say something like, the great news is because again, I'm not throwing shade, but because cat behavior information is so minimal out there, even as a great cat mom, you go to try to find help. Most of what's out there is really bad. So the good news is you actually haven't tried anything. Because in most cases, they haven't. I love feel away, but behavior is complex, man. It's a lot more than adding a box and giving them feel away. And I'm not trying to be rude. It's also a lot more than just prescribing fluoxetine. Like, if you're going to prescribe behavior meds and not do behavior modification, that's a whole nother problem, which sometimes happens. And the client thinks it's this weird, I have a Harry Potter wand that I bring to consults. And I say, magic, again, I don't know if it's because I'm cute, because I am like very short. I have tattoos. I have colored hair. I'm a very like bubbly person, but I'm like, magic doesn't work. And then I like shake up the wand and they all laugh, but it's just me setting realistic expectations with my clients from the start. Like, this is going to be work and your cat's not doing this because they're spiteful. Magic doesn't exist, or I'd live in Hawaii and I would not be doing this for a living. But it's a really good icebreaker. And I'm sure as veterinary technicians, we all find our own little spiels for those difficult conversations. And over the years, I've found mine and how to communicate more effectively with people who may be saying things that can be very hard to hear.
Gotcha. Real quick, I had a follow-up question for earlier that I forgot to ask. You'll have to forgive me. But, you know, Dave and I have worked emergency for a long, long time. And one common, I guess you could say, complaint or thought or what have you that gets said often is fear-free just can't work in a high-volume emergency practice. Like, it's just, there's, you know, it takes too long. It's, we got to get them in, we got to get them out, all these things. How do you approach something like that?
I love that you asked that because it's something I commonly hear too. So I have a spiel.
Great. Spiel away.
So I do low-cost vaccine clinics where I see animals who are from, and humans who are doing the best with what they can in the moment, but from situations where these animals are usually unsocialized, so they're more fearful, they tend to have more aggressive behaviors due to that fear, and I have 3 to 4 minutes with each of them. If I didn't know low stress and fear-free well, there's no way most of those clients would be seen. So that's where, when I'm talking to someone in emergency, I always say it like this because people are like, it takes longer. And I'm like, actually, it took me a minute to do that nail trim. You guys have been fighting with that dog for 30 minutes and someone got bit and the dog's over threshold and the dog is going to have a negative experience and not walk into your hospital next time because they've generalized this fear to your whole building, maybe even the car ride. So I always say handling is a skill, and this is something I feel very strongly about, so I may get a little louder because I get really passionate because I'll be honest, we do not treat it as a skill in our field. I'm not trying to be rude, but it's hot take. We do not treat handling as a skill. I was taught 2 restraint techniques that are outdated that I have not used in over 5 years for cats and dogs, and then we're kind of just thrown to the wolves, kind of. And handling is all about working with the patient in front of you and adapting based on how that patient's doing. So I have 35 to 50 handling techniques just off the top of my head. And that's probably why my animals that I work with, I tend not to see these, like, again, that label, but fractious animals or fear, anxiety, stress 4 or 5, which is like the red, because usually I've done so much work that they aren't in the red. And in an emergency situation where they're probably coming in the red because the poor things are painful as heck or in shock, I think fear-free can be really effective because it helps to keep people safe. You definitely want to decrease the animal's blood pressure. I mean, realistically, if they're bleeding out, and there are a lot of things, because a lot of shelters and vet clinics are like, I can't do this. I'm like, we can't control everything, but there is a lot we can control. And it could be something as small as like putting lidocaine on a dog when they walk in, or I'm going to walk you right into a room and not have you go by 5 screaming dogs. When I talk about them to staff, they're like, that makes sense. But these things take practice. So I always, if I'm lecturing, I point out a vet because I call them out. I love them. And I'm like, how long was your first face surgery in school? And they may say 2 to 3 hours. And I'm like, that's amazing. How long is it now? 15 minutes. I'm like, cool. Handling. How many of you have gotten additional training? None of you. No way. Because again, even like I'll hear a tech say something like towel restraint doesn't work. Towel restraint's a lot more than throwing a towel over a cat. But right. That is not what people understand. I think we need to take handling more seriously and realize I much rather have a skilled handler than a skilled phlebotomist any day. Now, but what is a skilled handler, right? There aren't as many of them as you would imagine, because most of us, to be fair, we're not really setting our technicians up for success because we're literally giving them one restraint for each patient and not telling them to critically think and, hey, let's work with this patient. This cat's a 13-year-old cat. I'm probably going to draw from a cephalic while she's on my shoulder and not a medial saphenous because it's very likely she has arthritis in her back. You know, things like my brain just goes there. But yeah. None of that stuff was taught to me. So I know this is a really long answer, but usually I say it does take less time, but fear-free is a skill. Handling is a skill. And it's not something that I love fear-free, but it's a lot. You have to do more than just take an 8-hour module. Like I'm not
right.
You really have to practice. Like I practiced on stuffed animals, and then I started practicing on the dogs at work because I did this all in like real life time. And now mostly all I see is 4 or 5 FAS 4 or 5 patients. And it's wonderful. And I love it. I wouldn't want anyone else to see it because that's another thing I tell my clients. Handling fearful animals is a skill and your vet is amazing, but that might not be their skill set. So we're going to go to this vet where I can work with them. Again, we all have good things about us. We should lift each other up, but not all of us are skilled at handling fearful patients. And that is a specialty
that I
would love for more of us to work on.
Absolutely.
Well, Tabitha, we've taken up a lot of your time tonight. this has been fantastic. I never thought I would learn so much in an hour and 10 minutes just talking about behavior. This was way better than I expected.
And I've been writing a list of people that I know will love to hear this episode that I will for sure tell them like on Sunday, like check this episode out. You're going to love it. Like great. It's been fantastic.
And we're going to have a lot of links in the show, notes for...
Yeah.
You're gonna have to send us a lot of links.
I will send you guys. Yes. If people are like, I want to learn more, I'm like, I will overwhelm you, and I'm all about it.
please.
So before we wrap up, is there anything else that we haven't covered tonight that you want to get out to our listeners before we wrap up?
Remind your clients that cats aren't spiteful; they're not humans, and try to describe behavior instead of use labels. Let's stop with the muzzle. If I see muzzle fractious or bites on a note, I'm like, this tells me the staff is afraid of the animal. It literally gives me no other information. Learn body language and describe behavior. So describe what behavior you're seeing instead of using labels. And thank you so much for everything you guys are doing. Your podcast is wonderful. And I love that you're allowing lots of different voices to be spoken and advocating for technicians.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, we are not going to let you go that easy because, as you know, we have a would you rather question. Are you ready?
Yes.
Would you rather double the size of all mosquitoes or double the size of all spiders?
Spiders.
Spiders?
They're adorable. Really? I love them.
Oh, wow.
Mosquitoes transmit disease and they hurt.
This is true. Very true. Very well, spiders hurt too. Well, sometimes, yeah. But, well, but I mean, true, we have, with the disease thing. Absolutely. Yeah.
We have so many spiders on our farm. Like, I go out with, I look kind of silly. I go out with a flashlight on my forehead. And when you shine a light on the ground, you see all those little dots shining back at you. Those are all spider eyes.
Oh, jeez.
And I showed that to somebody and they're like, I hate you for telling me that.
Yeah, don't ever post a picture of that on my
no,
wall.
No, that see that is alarming. I agree, but I'll try to. I'll be like, it's a cute, cuddly spider because it's bigger.
But if you think about spiders, what do spiders eat?
Mosquitoes.
Mosquitoes
and bugs that we don't like, which is another reason. Very exactly. true. I'm a huge fan of spiders.
I'd very rather true. Have spiders.
Very true. Again, see that whole. Man, I cannot raise a family where I grew up because that whole bubble of orange, we didn't have bugs, we didn't have ticks, we didn't have spiders.
That's crazy.
Like, it's a concrete jungle. Like I'm telling you, like that stuff did not exist. And so like as a 41-year-old adult, I'm like terrified of these things.
Jeff, did you see the picture that Robin posted? I don't know.
Yes, of the snake next to the hen.
The snake in the chicken coop.
Yes, yeah. Yes, terrifying. Absolutely. Like I want to burn your farm down.
Oh, gosh.
I totally understand. Like it's necessary, but like it's just not something I grew up with. So I'm like inherently. Terrified
from your learning history. See, your learning history is
exactly what we've been talking about. That's why this was such a great question.
All right, Tabitha. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate all this information. This
seriously, thank you so much for. I mean, you reached out to us a long time ago about this, and we finally made it happen. And it's such a great, you know, a huge topic, as you said. And there's. I mean, I work in academia and I feel like we do a really good job of trying to educate the students about fear-free and behavioral training and a lot of this stuff. But as you said, like everybody has different skill sets, and for some people, this is their jam and for some people not. And it's okay to bring our heads together and work for a common solution. And that's really cool.
Yes. Teamwork makes the dream work.
Absolutely. Oh, there you go. Absolutely. Well, thanks again for your time and for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe for a cup of coffee, and enjoy your weekend.
Thank you so much.
Bye, guys.
Thank you. We would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. We often talk about difficult issues facing our profession and chat with colleagues who have strong opinions of those issues. As such, we feel it is important to note that the opinions and views expressed by us as the hosts or our guests on the Vet Tech Cafe podcast are solely theirs and theirs alone, and do not represent any other person, business, institution, or any other entity. If you have questions relating to this, please email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Lastly, as Dave said during the intro, please like us, follow us, and take a minute to rate and review the Vet Tech Cafe podcast on whatever podcast platform you use. It really does help. Thanks again for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe.